last living member of the original Bonnie and Clyde gang, he came to that place in his life where one day he had to reach out beyond himself. Thank God when he did, he reached out to Jesus Christ. He wants to share with you tonight some of the things that have happened in his life, and of the greatest thing that happened in his life when he discovered that new life in Jesus Christ. So, Big Jim, it's all yours.
Precious Heavenly Father, have mercy upon your word tonight. And let it touch the hearts of someone out there that's unsaved, that know you not as their Savior. My friend, I'm 73 years old, I'll soon be 74. I've only been a Christian 6 years. The first thing I would like for you to know, that I was raised in a Christian home. Brother Chuck, my mother lived to be 97, and 90 years of that 97, she served God. And my dad lived to be 86, and 75 of his 86 years, he served God. There were 9 boys in my family and 5 girls. I have brothers that's ministers, uncles that's ministers. My grandfather was a minister. I was the black sheep of the family. I did not rebel against my parents, because my dad had asked me to do something. I tried my best to please him. And if my mother said white was black, to me it was black. My mother was my queen. I never gave one of my parents an unkind word. But I had a mean, vicious, ungodly, insane temper. And once I got started, there wasn't no stopping me. I remember the first thing I ever stole. I didn't associate at that time with crime, because at that age, the age of 12, I had to ask permission to leave the yard. My parents were that strict. But the boy came to my home one morning and asked me to go to the old furnace bottom in Bristol, Virginia to play. I got permission from my mother to go. When we got over in the old furnace bottom, there wasn't any of the gang there, and we wandered around the Southern Railway spur line till we come to the Southern Railway yards. And there was a freight train sitting there. And neither one of us had ever ridden a freight train. But we crawled on that freight train and got down into a sand car, a gondola, and hid. We intended to ride just 5 miles and get off and come back, walk back. We had plenty of time. But when we got to where we were going, that train was running so fast we couldn't get off. So we had to ride it into Johnson City, Tennessee. 25 miles from home. And the largest thing I ever stole in my life, it was too big to carry. I couldn't hide it. I couldn't put it on the highway, and I couldn't take it home. How many of you would try to guess what it was? It was a Southern Railway locomotive. This 12-year-old boy and I, we had played around in the yards like two boys of that age. And the sun was going down, and I had a certain time to be at home, and so did this boy. And the sun begun to go down, and we knew it. I could feel that strap. So the shifter crew brought the shifter in and set it on a siding. And they left. I presume they went to dinner. But John and I, I'll call him John, we got onto the shifter and we turned a valve here and we'd turn one there and we'd pull a lever here and a lever there. And we got it to rolling forward a little bit and then we'd pull it back and get it to backing up. And eventually we decided that that was our transportation home. So I got off and threw the switch to the main line and we fired that shifter up and drove it into Bristol, Tennessee, right into the yards. And as we passed through Bluff City, Tennessee, we ducked down in the cab. And the telegrapher there wired ahead that there was a runaway locomotive and there was a passenger train coming down pretty soon. So they set out derailments right there in Bristol. But when we got to where we was originally supposed to go, we come as cutting off valves here and there, valve there, and slowing it down. We got it slowed down, got it stopped. And I believe, my friends, if my broad jump had been recorded when I left the cab of that engine, that had never been broken. I made it home just under the wire. But then just a short while later, the same boy and I went back to Johnson City on a freight train. This time we knew we were doing wrong. We went upon Fountain Square and stole a Model T Ford and drove that Model T Ford back into Bristol and parked it on 6th Street. And I believe I could go back there today and walk to the spot where we parked it. The next thing I got into, I got to where I could drive, and I spent just about everything that I made on rent-a-Ford. They used to call them rent-a-Fords. And an old man got after another boy and I to go over into South Carolina and get him a load of whiskey. So we went. He gave us some money to buy the whiskey, and we got over and got to having a good time and spent his money and everything else, and called him and told him we'd been held up, and he sent us some more money, and we spent that. And he had us picked up and towed in the Spartanburg County Jail. Well, my dad, I wouldn't write my dad and mother and tell them where I was at, but John did. My dad and John's dad came over, and they wanted to know what the score was. Wanted to know how come us. I wouldn't tell them nothing. But John copped out. And my dad went back to the old man. I'll call him Mr. Trammell. He was a well-known bootlegger in that part of the country. And he told him, said, I give you just until 5 o'clock tomorrow evening to have my boy at home. Well, I'm going to pick you up by the nape of the neck and carry you over to the jail and tell them why my boy is in jail. And my dad was a very small man. He just stood 7 foot and weighed 360 pounds. They called me Big Jim. I weigh 210 pounds. And I'm the smallest one of the men in my family. But that led from one thing to another. And young people, you get by with one little thing, then you try something a little bit bigger, then something a little bigger. Until eventually there's no turning back. And the sad part of my life came when I was 17 years old. I killed my first man. He was a senior in high school, and I was in my second year. He and I had fought with our fists many a time. And they'd separate us and get us separated. So one day he came on the school ground and he said he was going to cut me into pieces. I found me a rock about the size of a teacup, and I went hunting him. I wanted to find out if he would cut me. And he did. Me reaching for a knife. But the first lick I struck him in the temple with that rock. And he went down. And I went down on top of him with my brothers and my sisters and the teachers all begging me not to kill him. But I literally beat his brains out on the schoolhouse ground. When the police come, they turned him over. The boy was dead. But he had an open knife in his hand, and there was blood on it. And my hand was bloody. And it was called self-defense. Just about a year later, I killed another boy by the name of Andrew Eads. This was more or less an accidental killing. I had an axle out of a Model T Ford, and he and his brother come on me, and I punched him in the stomach with it, and when he bent over, I intend to catch him across the shoulders. But my aim was bad, and I caught him at the base of the skull, and it killed him. I was tried for murder in the state of Virginia. I was found guilty of manslaughter. I was given 8 years in the penitentiary at Richmond, Virginia. I spent about between 7 and 8 months on the road gang, and I told my cellmate one evening that I was going to hang it up. And to a convict's phrase, that means that I'm going to run, that I'm going to escape if I can. But I had a 27-pound ball and a 7-foot chain latched onto my ankle. And we were working a road gang. And the next day I raised my hand that I had to go to the side of the road for physical relief. and the guard gave me permission to go. I was not supposed to reach down and get that ball. I was supposed to drag it. But I reached down and got that ball and got it up in my arms and gathered that chain up. And when I hit that brush, I hit it running with everything it was in me. And there was about 25 shotguns and rifles on the line, and they were all shooting at me. The trustee had to go back about a mile to the camp to get the dogs to trail me. And I outrun the guards and the dogs and all of them till I come to a river, a wide creek. And I went into this creek, I went in going downstream, and whatever made me turn and go back upstream, I don't know. But when I got about middle ways, I turned and went back upstream. And I say I was within 300 yards of them when they went into the water and see my tracks going downstream, and they went that way. If they'd have come upstream, they'd have caught me. But I waded that river, and there was time that I was in water this deep. If I'd ever got into a hole over my head, I would have drowned it. That ball would have held me down. But God so seemed fit that I didn't get into that hole. I came to an old barn. I broke into this barn and I found a piece of hacksaw blade. And I cut the rivet on that shack. And there was an old suitcase, one of his old grip-tight suitcases sitting there. You younger people don't know too much about them, but the older ones do. And I didn't want to leave that ball and chain there for fear that the man that owned the property, that they might find it there and accuse him of helping escape convict, or aiding and betting an escape convict. And I put that ball and chain in that suitcase, and I carried that ball and chain for 3 years and over, all through California, Parowan, Utah, McCall, Idaho. Everywhere I went, I had that ball and chain with me. And a friend of mine that lives up in Modesto, California, he went to town one day, and he came back with a quart of red paint. And we painted that ball and chain red and boxed it up and shipped it back to the state of Virginia, COD. Well, I knew when I shipped that ball and chain back, I knew that I either had to start running again or go back and give myself up. So I went back and gave myself up. And the old judge that had sent me up the first time, he said, I could give you 5 additional years for running. But said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you time served. And I didn't understand just what he meant at that time. But he told me that I'd suffered more running than I would have if I'd have stayed with the chain gang, because he had already cut my sentence from 8 years down to 2. But he said, I'm sending you back to the walls, said you won't run anymore. It wasn't but just a few months until he cut my sentence and I was released. I went back home, young people. I was an ex-convict, but I wanted to go back to school. But I had no opportunity to go to school. And remember this well, that one time that you changed your name for a number, you're branded the rest of your life. I'm a man without a country. My citizenship has been taken away from me. I can't vote. I'm on a conditional pardon. And the least thing that I do, or somebody get mad at me or something like that, and take me up, I'd spend the rest of my days behind walls. But that's what I try to get over to you young people, that once you change your name for a number, you're branded the rest of your days. Even among your own people, they might not say it to your face, but to your back, and to your neighbors and your friends, he's the next convict. You're no more thought of other than just being an ex-convict. After I seen I couldn't go back to school, I came to Texas and met one of the finest girls that ever lived and married her. She was Pentecostal and I was Baptist. Or raised in a Baptist church. And because she wouldn't leave her Pentecostal faith, I left her. But you know, I thank God for her today. At one time, I wouldn't have given Pentecostal people the time of day. But today, I wish my arms was big enough that I could just reach out and gather them up. I love them all. Because I'm Pentecostal all the way through. I'm saved, sanctified, and filled with the Holy Ghost. And I'm proud to tell any church or any minister, yes, I'm Pentecostal. I don't condemn other churches because Christ doesn't look over the name of the church to see whether it's Pentecostal or Baptist or Methodist. He looks at that individual's heart. And when we get up to glory, we're going to find them all there. But after my wife and I separated. I worked for an old man by the name of Walker there in Wheeler County, Texas, on a ranch. And I worked out an old Model T Ford. And then I went to the southwest, to Arizona, New Mexico, and southwest Texas, and down in the southern part of California, and worked all around. And I made it my business to look up the old gunslingers and the old outlaws and the old lawmen. Yes, I met and I talked to the great White Earp. White Earp died in 1929 in Phoenix, Arizona. And I talked to White Earp. And when I said he was a great marshal, I wasn't making any remarks about him because he was a great marshal. And I have all the respect in the world today for peace officers. And young people, let me tell you this, that 90% of the peace officers we have today is the best friend that you've got. If you talk to them right and you give them the right answers and you don't try to bulldoze them, oh yes, there's a few that's rotten. That's what makes the whole, you throw a bad apple in a barrel and the whole barrel stinks. That's why it makes it so bad. But 99% of the peace officers we have today, they've been screened, they've been educated, and they know their job, and they will talk to you and advise you, and they are your friends. They wouldn't like the back were back in my days. But getting back to my story of Arizona, I met Emmett Dalton, Grant Dalton, Will Dalton, and Henry Starr. Henry Starr is the man that taught me how to draw and shoot from the hip. And at one time, I was known to be the fastest gunman alive. Emmett Dalton is the man that gave me the name of the Sundown Kid. And you can go into most any of these bookstores and buy books, The Legend of the Sundown Kid. Lou Lauterbacher wrote one or two books about me. Cal Everts wrote one. Bill Tallman wrote one. There's been a number of people that's wrote the story on the legend of the Sundown Kid. But to take one incident in my life and made a story out of it. While I was working in Yuma, Arizona, after I was married and came to Arizona, Mr. Walker, the old man that I worked the Ford out for, I got a letter from his son that his dad had been shot in the back by one of the fastest gunmen in the state of Texas, Matt Bellflower. And when I got that letter in Yuma, I was a wild man. I drove that Ford from Yuma, Arizona to Wheeler, Texas. And I got into Wheeler about the 22nd or 23rd of December, 1921. I went directly to my father-in-law's home and cleaned up. I told him what I was there for. I was there to kill Matt Bellflower. They begged me. They said, "You don't have a chance. He's the fastest gunman in the state of Texas." I didn't care how fast he was. I knew I was a little faster because I'd had the best teacher that a man could have, Henry Starr. He taught me to shoot with both hands or one hand, and preferably left-handed. I'm faster left-handed with a gun than I am right-handed, even though I'm right-handed. But that's the way he taught me. On Christmas Eve 1921, I found Matt Bellflower in the Mercantile in Wheeler, Texas. I called him out. I told him that I was going to kill him. And he said, "Big Jim, I don't have any fight with you." I spit in his face. I said, "Now you have." He said, "No, I don't have no fight with you." And again, I spit in his face. And I said, "Now you have." He said, "No." And I told him, I said, "Matt, either draw your guns in here in the store or go through the street." I said, "And there's children in the store, and I'd hate to see anyone get killed or hurt. It's just you and I." He went to the street, and he turned as if to walk away from me. But Henry Starr had well taught me the old border turn. As he turned like he was going to walk away from me, he made a pass for his guns. And my first bullet caught him in the right shoulder. And my intentions were just to stand and just shoot him to pieces. Not to shoot him in any vital spot, but just cut him all to pieces. But he fell on his hands and knees and looked up into my face and said, "For God's sakes, Big Jim, don't kill me." And I said, "You didn't give Mr. Walker a chance. Why should I give you one?" And out of hate and revenge, I walked up over that man and thumbed two shots in the top of his head. The sheriff, John Porter, said he was reaching for his left-hand gun all the time that he was talking to me. He was trying to throw me off a guard till he could get that gun out. Said if he hadn't been reaching for that gun, I'd try you for murder. 2 weeks later, I had to meet his brother, John Bellflower, and kill him. Then I left there. I went back to Arizona. I had to meet the Brumley boys, and thank God I didn't have to kill either one of them. I crippled both of them. Then I had to meet I.C. Thurman. This is not anything funny, my friends, because I got so sick of gunfights. I got so sick of killing that it was pitiful. I went back to Texas and I hung my guns up. And my guns, I kept them hung up for several months. And a man that I had slept under the blankets with, I eat out of the same frying pan with him. I drank out of the same coffee cup with him. He rode into my father-in-law's yard one morning and called me out. My wife begged me not to go out, but I told her I've got to go. That's either go or run. And I'm not running. And as I stepped out the door, she stepped up into the door, and Bill Smith asked me to move to one side that she wouldn't be in the line of fire.
And when he said slap leather, I knew what he meant. And my bully caught him between the eyes, and his bully caught me right between my feet. That's the nearest I ever come being out wrong. Well, I've been bushwhacked a number of times, and if anyone is interested, after the service, I'll show you bullet holes in my head. I'll show you bullet holes in my shoulders. Of course, I've got them in my chest that I can't show. But I can show this in my head and the ones in my shoulders. But I hung my guns up after the killing of Bill Smith. And I decided to go into the United States Army. I lied about my prison record, and I got into the Army, and they gave me a chance. And I'll never forget the day that I met Clyde and Bonnie, Clyde Barr and Bonnie Parker. I was hitchhiking from El Reno to Shamrock, Texas, and they picked me up. They asked me if I knew who they were, and I told them, yes, I knew who they were. But they had no fear for me because I hated John Law, too. And I did at that time. And I told them who I was, and Clyde said, I'm exhausted. Will you drive for me to where you're going? He crawled over in the back seat. He and Bonnie went to sleep, and I drove about 15 miles west of Amarillo, Texas, and pulled off onto a side road and woke them up, told them where they were at. And Clyde Barr gave me five $100 bills. He asked me where he could get in touch with me if he needed me. And I gave him a number, telephone number and everything. It wasn't too long after that until he called me at Fort Reno and he'd had a wreck and Bonnie had been severely burned in a wreck. And they needed a hideout. I hid them out on the northwest corner of the military reservation at Fort Reno, Oklahoma, and an old line shack that hadn't been used in years. I was a permanent guard. I had from 12 to 6 at night the permanent guard duty, and I'd steal a little food jar and a little medication there, and first one thing, then the other, and whatever they needed. Just enough that it wouldn't be missed too much. And I kept them there 3 months. Until Bonnie got able to travel. They asked me if I could get them a car, and I went into El Reno and stole them a car. It wasn't long after that I got another call from Fort Smith, Arkansas. It was Clyde. He had a big caper on, or a big robbery. And he wanted to know if I wanted a piece of it. My young friend, if I'd have had one brain in my head, I'd have said no. But I said yes. I tried to get a pass, I couldn't get it. I tried to get a furlough, I couldn't get it. And I went absent without leave. And eventually it turned into desertion. And during the time, the 2 years and 8 months that I was with Clyde and Bonnie, we shot it out at Joplin, Missouri. We shot it out at Atoka, Oklahoma. There were 2 peace officers killed on the Grapevine Road right out of Dallas, Texas, that was packed on to Clyde, but Clyde had nothing to do with it. He wasn't the president at the time, but he had nothing to do with it. Frank Kloss did the gunning down of these 2 peace officers. There was a shootout at Dexter and one at Corinda Highway. On the Corinda Highway, Buck was killed, Clyde's brother. And I swam the North Platte River with Bonnie on my back and Clyde by the shirt collar. They was both wounded. And I believe I ran into the stubbornest old lady there that I ever ran into in my life. She had an old Pierce Arrow car. She knew who we were, but she would have died before she gave us the keys to that old Pierce Arrow car. But we finally got the wires crossed and got it going. And we would have probably been better off walking if Clyde and Bonnie hadn't been wounded. But anyway, finally we got to so much that there wasn't any turning back. And my young friends, how would you like to go down the road, every turn in the road you're expecting to run into hail of bullets from a posse? Every time you turn a corner, you're expecting to be shot down. You can't turn your back on your friends, the ones you think your friends, for fear of being shot in the back. You can have $1,000 in your pocket and you can't walk into a grocery and buy a loaf of bread. How would you like to get down and drink water out of a horse's crack? I've had it to do. How would you like to give $100 a night to sleep on a dirty shack floor? To go hungry for days and have money in your pocket? And every time you see a peace officer, you've got to shoot it out with him, kill him, or run. I'm here to tell you tonight that crime pays off in heartaches and sorrow, humiliation, and every form that you can think of that way. Disgrace, dishonor. That's the way the crime pays off. But if you don't want that kind of payoff, then remember this, that crime does not pay. I spent 35 years in the penitentiary for bank robbery and murder. I got 364 years in the state of Texas. I got 194 in Mississippi and 99 in Arkansas. I spent 18 years in Texas. They turned me over to Mississippi. I spent time in Mississippi. They turned me over to Arkansas. And you figure that time up. That's 657 years. You just think of that. A man drawn 657 years. And I've had people ask me, how did you get out of so much? And the only answer I have for them is by my mother's prayers and the mercies of God. Only by the mercy of God that it's not Brother Chuck here that's standing here telling you this story. It's only by the mercy of God it's not one of you young ladies that was taking Bonnie Parker's place or Blanche's. Just remember that, only by the mercies of God. And I was paroled. And while I was on parole, I married another woman as bad as the first one was good. And I caught her in bed with the sheriff of Washington County, Virginia, and killed them both. I was tried and convicted for first-degree premeditated murder and sentenced to die in the electric chair. The sentence was returned. The Supreme Court ruled it down and sent it back for new trial. Again, it was rejected and it was sent down, and each time it was the same sentence until the third time it come down, and there's the same sentence to die in the electric chair. And while I was on death row 28 months in the state of Virginia, I seen 11 men go to the chair. And now 11 men, Brother Chuck, I seen one man that went with his head high. He didn't have to have no help. They didn't have to drag him. They didn't have to assist him. He was a little colored boy by the name of Lonnie Howard. And the night before he was to die the next morning, he held on to the bars of the cell and sang, "Pass me not, O gentle Savior. Pass me not, O gentle Savior." He said, "Boys, I'm not guilty." And I was next to go, and I was in the next cell to him. And I've heard him pray many a prayer. "God, forgive that young white lady. She doesn't know what she said." But the morning they came down to get Lonnie Howard to take him to his death, he was just 13 steps from that little green door at the end of the corridor. But he asked permission to go back to the end of death row and shake hands with each and every man. As he stuck his hand out, he said, "Boys, it's not so bad if you've got Christ on your side. It's not so bad if you've got Christ on your side." He shook hands with me, with every man on death row. And the last words I ever heard him say was, "Thank God, I'll soon get home in glory." He walked down that corridor. As he went back, the guards moved in close to him, and he just pushed them to the side. He didn't want them close. And as the warden got to the door and he rapped on the door for the guard on the inside of the death chamber to open the door, Lonnie Howard just turned around and waved goodbye. Just like if he's going out on the yard and be back. just like he's going home,
which he was.
He was going home because he just said, thank God, I'll soon be at home with Jesus. 5 days before I was to go, my parents, my mother rather, my father had passed away, but my brothers and sisters, my children, come to see me as the last time they had any chance to be with me at any length of time. And they spent the day with me. That evening when the warden come and said it was time to go, my brothers and sisters and children were all crying. But that little mother of mine didn't have a tear in her eye. She just walked up to me and put her arms around me and said, son, look up. And whence thine help come? And she turned to the warden of the penitentiary there, and she said, the chair hasn't been built. No, the electricity will never be generated that'll take my boy's life. I thought, oh, mother, if you only knew. There was little windows at the top of the cell block. And the morning you'd raise up and you'd see daylight, and you'd close your eyes and look up again, and it'd be dark. It just seemed like time flew. But 2 days later, every legal avenue of escape had been exhausted. Every avenue of escape had been exhausted but one. And that was my mother's prayer. My mother never gave up. And 2 days later, the warden, the governor, sent down a reprieve. And my sentence was cut from death unto life imprisonment. And 14 months later, the United States Supreme Court ruled it justifiable homicide, and I was set free. I was still on parole. You'd have thought something like that would have got next to a man and would have changed him. But it didn't change me. I just said there's an easier way to make a dollar than to robbing banks and going to prison and being in prison. So I affiliated myself with a well-known underworld gang. I'll name it. There may be some of you here. But if you are, I'm not afraid because Christ has got a shield around me. I affiliated myself with the mafia. I was a gunsel for the mafia. They set me up in a bar. Then I went to more bars and bigger bars and bigger bars. I was a professional gambler, and I can read the back of any deck of cards that you want to break open fast as I can read my Bible. A man who sat down beside in front of me. There was only one man, and he was killed a little while back, that was equal with me. And we played together. I dealt him a good hand, he'd deal me one. And I stole everything I had. And I was a multimillionaire. When I was saved, I had everything in the world that money could offer me. I'd gone to Vegas on Wednesday and sat in a poker game until Sunday morning. And then when I came down, there was two dolls and a window. And I had two little friends. Their mother was a very dedicated Christian woman and a very good friend of mine. And she had two daughters. And I bought those daughters, those dolls, for those little girls. Bobby drove the car. My common-law wife drove the car back to Phoenix. And I slept because I hadn't slept from Wednesday to Sunday morning. Sunday morning, I got up and got ready. And I said, I'm going to take the dolls by the girls and give them to them. We'd taken them. Their mother had got them ready to go to Sunday school. And little Debbie, a 9-year-old girl, came and placed her arms around me. Looked up at my face and said, Big Carl, go to Sunday school with me. I patted her on the head. I said, no, baby, that's for you. You go to Sunday school, you be a good girl. That's for you, it's not for me. She placed a little penny in my hand that had been mashed out and had the Lord's Prayer engraved on it. I looked at it and read it, and through respect for the child, I put it in my pocket. That afternoon, working around the bar, I ran my hand in my pocket and I found it, and I threw it over into a 55-gallon drum of broken whiskey bottles, beer bottles, vomit, filth, you name the filth around the bar room, and it was in that barrel. And I didn't think too much more about it until I got home and got ready to go to bed. And that little piece of copper comes floating before my face. I buried my face in the pillow. I couldn't get rid of it. I covered my face up with the covers. I couldn't get rid of it. I put my hand over my eyes. That little piece of copper still was there. And I got up between 1 and 2 o'clock and begun to put on my clothes. And Bobby asked me where I was going. I told her I'd forgot something at the bar. I was going back after it. She said she was going along. I said, well, hurry up and get a flashlight. Because I knew the garbage bin come around early. And I drove 18 miles back into Phoenix. Drove around behind the bar, and I dumped that drum up on the pavement. And I got down on my hands and knees and through that filth, I searched until I found my penny. A multimillionaire hunting a lost penny that would soon lead him to Christ. And my friend, from that Sunday morning until the following Thursday night, I didn't eat nor sleep. I can't tell you what state of mind I was in. Like Brother Chuck was talking about the young lady that went so far that she had no further to go. Had she had stopped and thought she had a long ways to go. When I went, and I tried to put up a big face, a big show, and on Wednesday I had an appointment with my attorney in Phoenix, and I went to his office. And for the first time in all my life, I began to cry. I thought I was losing my mind. I didn't know what was wrong. I got up and walked out of his office. I've never seen him yet today. I bought a plane ticket to San Diego. Flew in San Diego, went to the best hotel in San Diego, and I've taken enough of sleeping pills to kill a half a dozen men. But the only thing they would do would just make me fall and ill, and I'd bomb them back up. I have a Christian friend that lives over at Bakersfield. I couldn't rest at the hotel. I come down and checked out. I said, I'm going over and see Merle and see if I can talk to him. I got over to Bakersfield and I went to Merle's home. And he looked at me and he said, Big Carl, the only thing you need is Christ in your life. And I told him, I said, man, don't preach to me. Can't you see I'm upset enough? He said, that's all what's wrong with you today. I said, call me a cab. He said, I'll take you down. I said, no, I don't want to hear your preaching. But I got into Bakersfield and I got to walking around over the street. And I made this statement while walking the street. What in the hell have I got to live for? I was a multimillionaire. I had a bar who was making money. I had one of the nicest homes in the state of Arizona. I had one of the most attractive women in that part of the country. But I still liked that one thing that Merle Savage told me I liked. I bought a bus ticket to Oakland. I have a former wife in Oakland. I own bars over in Oakland at one time. And I was going to Oakland and sign everything over to her. Then I was going to do it in. I was going to take a gun and blow my brains out. But God didn't intend for me to do that, and he had kept five states from doing, and a dozen gunmen and underworld characters. He didn't intend for me to do it. And in Modesto, I don't know whether it was a bus stop or a rest or what. But anyway, I got come out of there. And all of you know a bus ticket, the destination is plainly on the bottom. I handed the bus driver the ticket, and he looked at it and taken it. I got on the wrong bus at the right time. I wound up in Stockton. I'll ask him what time he went on to Oakland. He said he didn't go to Oakland. He went on north, but he said, come in here and I'll fix it up. It was about 3:30 in the evening. I had until 9:30 that night. I got to wandering around over Stockton. And I seen a group of men at a building. And I didn't know what a rescue mission was. I'd heard of them. but I didn't know what they were. And I walked over there, and these men, I was well-dressed, these men separated, and I walked in. They fell on the door, opened the door, and let me in. And I walked in, and I sat down on the very back row. And I remember moving up about halfway. But that's as far as I can remember. The only thing I could see was the Rock of Ages to my left and my mother's Lord hanging on that Rock of Ages. My friends, I can't tell you whether I ran, walked, or crawled to that altar. I can't tell you whether they sang a song that night or not, or preached a message. When I came to myself, I was pouring out my heart to God. I had a 9-carat diamond ring on my hand. I pulled it off and laid it on that altar. I had a diamond-studded wristwatch on my arm. I laid it on that altar. I had $37,000 in money in my pocket, and I laid it on that altar. I had a .38 police special, a gun, and under each armpit. And I'd taken those guns out and laid them on that altar. Then I lifted my arms. And said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And save me for Christ's sake. And use me if you can. My friend, at that moment the world was lifted off my shoulders. The next day I called Mary and told her what would happen. And that was Debbie's mother, the little girl that had given me the penny. And Mary called Debbie and told her. And Debbie, I could hear her running over the house hollering, thank God, thank God, thank God. I called the manager of the bar and told him to give everybody a month's salary and to close the bar. Close the doors. I told Mary to go down and see that it was closed, that I wasn't coming back right away. I called Bobby and told her what was happening, or what had happened. I had surrendered my life to God. She said to me to come on back. I was acting like a child. I said, I am a child. I'm a child of God's. But little Debbie had taken a piece of cardboard and a school crayon and wrote a message on it and stuck it in the front of that barroom window. Gone to church. I have gone around since I was saved, and I made restitutions to those that I know that stole from. Until I was penniless. My life story's been wrote at this time. It'll come out on Spring Press. And the title of that story will be From Riches to Rag to Riches. How many of you know what that means? All you Christians should know. I was a millionaire when I was saved. I gave it all away, but now I'm laying up treasures in glory. I have a little story. This is the end of my testimony at the present time. I've been going from place to place witnessing to young people. And my whole heart's desire is to see people saved. But I have a little story that I like to tell at the end of my testimony. This is not part of my testimony. It's just a story or a poem. There was a teenage boy ran in one day from school and hollered, "Mom, where are you, Mother?" Mother didn't answer him, and he went through the house searching, and he found her kneeling at a chair praying. And the boy very slowly backed away. He heard his mother call his name in prayer. The second day he went in, "Mom, where are you, Mother?" And again he found Mother praying at that chair. And again very quietly he backed out. He'd heard his mother call his name in prayer. And my friend, I've heard my precious mother call my name in prayer thousands of times. The third day he went in, "Mom, where are you, Mother?" And again he found Mother kneeling. He said, "I know my mother's a Christian, and I know she prays, but I'm going to stay here and find out what this is all about." And he stayed there very quietly until Mother got through praying and got up. And he taken her in his arms and said, "Mother, are you sick?" She said, "No, son." Said, "Are you in trouble, Mother?" She said, "No, son." He said, "Oh, why are you praying so much here lately for?" She said, "I'm praying for you, son." He said, "Why praying for me so much, Mother?" She said, "The other evening I dreamed I went to heaven." Said, "And I walked over that great beautiful city of heaven." Said, "I heard music and singing." Said, "And I came to a great cathedral. And I walked up." Said, "The doors were solid gold and the hinges were silver. And the knobs were made of precious stones." Said, "I opened that door and I heard the most beautiful singing and the most beautiful music that I've ever heard in all my life. But I couldn't see anyone but an old caretaker. And he came down the aisle as I went toward him. I introduced myself to him and he to me. It was the Apostle Paul." Said, "I asked him, where's all the beautiful singing and all the beautiful music?" He said, "That's the angels." She said, "Well, where are they at?" He said, "They're out delivering prayer requests." He showed me around over this great cathedral, and he came to a great room that was packed with beautiful wrapped packages. The most beautiful wrapped packages that you could ever see. And I asked him, "What are these?" And he said, "These are prayers that will never be answered." She said, "Why won't they be answered?" "They're so beautifully wrapped. They're so beautifully lit up. Why won't they be answered? He said, because the one that was praying gave up too soon. My friends, I'm thankful to God tonight that my mother's prayers wasn't found in that room of unanswered prayers. You know, about 5 minutes before my mother passed away, I was standing at her bedside and I reached down and kissed her on the forehead. As I said before, I was the black sheep of the family. But my mother was my queen. And I reached down and kissed her on the forehead. And I said, Mother, I've put every wrinkle in your face. I've put every gray hair in your head. Can you forgive me? She looked up to me and she said, Son, I forgave you long before you ever did it. But she said, you've never broken a promise to me in your life. And I hadn't, my friend. If I promised my mother something, I'd either do it or die trying. And I'd never broken a promise to her. She said, you've never broken a promise to me. Said, but just one more promise before I go out of this world and go to be with Daddy, that was my dad, my earthly father. Said, and our Lord. She said, just one more promise. I said, I will if I can, Mother. She said, meet me in heaven. That was 4 years before I was saved. But before I thought of what I was saying, Brother Chuck, I said, I will. And my mother closed her eyes and smiled and was gone just like that. She went on out to meet God and Dad. Because she knew that I was going to be saved. I had never broken a promise to her. And she knew that Christ would save my life. And I would be saved. So I can thank God today that I've never broken a promise to my mother. I've never gave my parents an unkind word. And my whole heart's desire is to see people saved. Now while all heads are bowed, when eyes are closed, no one look around, please. But is there one here tonight that will lift your hand and say, Big Jim, pray for me. I need Christ. Is there one? Just lift your hand. God bless you. 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 God bless you back there, my friend. God bless you. God bless you over to my right here. God bless you, my friend back there. God bless you, young lady. God bless you, Mother. As there are others that will reach up and say, Big Jim, I need Christ as my personal Savior. Have you got the nerve tonight that colored boy had that could walk out and Walker known that he was coming to his death or coming to life, I should have said. But knowing that he was going out of this world, you know, these young boys and girls that stood up here tonight have made this music and lifted Christ up. That's what I call a brave young man and a brave young woman. Some of you may have switchblade knives in your pocket. Some of you may have guns on you or chained. But you know what that makes you, my friend? A coward at heart. When I was packing a pair of 45s or a pair of 38s, I was a coward at heart because I couldn't face the world. Now, I couldn't face my fellow man out there. I had to have something to protect myself with. I was really a coward at heart. Yes, I would meet one or two gunmen. But to take my guns away from me, I was a coward. And any boy or girl or man or woman that doesn't have the nerve to stand up and proclaim Christ as their personal Savior, take it from me tonight. And don't take your revenge out on your pastor. Take it out on me. Because I'm the one that sent it. The man or woman that doesn't have the nerve to stand up and proclaim Christ and witness for Christ is a coward at heart. I was a coward all my life up until 6 years ago. I'll say 3.5 years ago, because I've only been witnessing for the Lord for about 3.5 years out of the 6. But then I began to be a brave man. Now you that raised your hands, would you in some way or the other work your way down here close by? And let's have prayer together. Will you come? These young people will stand up and give you room. Brother Chuck, will you come and give me a hand here? There's many here. You young people over there, you on the outside who raised your hand, we've seen you, Christ seen you. Come up. Come, my friends. These here that's here, come right on over. Some of you Christian boys and girls, would you stand up and let these that's non-Christian walk in here where they can get in close? You know what it means to be. Would you come in? Would you come in? You from the outside that want to come in, will you come in? Any here, come right upon the platform. If we can't make room down there, we'll make room up here. Because you're making the greatest decision you've ever made in all your life. You're making a decision that you'll never regret. And I'll say this, Brother Chuck, I've heard a lot about this church. But I think if you young people will just stay right here and under Brother Chuck's guidance, the ministry, that you'll receive blessings that you never know there was ever in this world. And think not of tomorrow, because tomorrow may never come. Continue in prayer. And go out and face somebody and tell them what Christ did for you. The greatest strength that I've ever found is when I got to witnessing for the Lord. When I'm not witnessing for the Lord, I grow weak. I'm going to turn this back over to Brother Chuck now.